3 weeks from this morning, we'll break out extra folding chairs to accommodate our largest crowd of the year. And there'll be joy and excitement because everybody loves a crowd. Not only loves it, but thinks it may mean something wonderful, because if we fill all the seats and have to find more, that must mean we are successful. It isn't easy to measure the intellectual and emotional growth that may be happening in people who attend church. So we pick a yardstick everybody understands. Schools want to be bigger. If enrollment is up, they claim success. Cities boast of population increases. Churches take their pulse by counting heads every Sunday and comparing this year's figures with those of last year. It's the way of the world, and it isn't about to change. But it may be possible to learn something from the attitude of Christ toward crowds. Over and over in the Gospels, he is shown leaving the crowd to go off by himself up into the hills to pray or to teach a small handful of people. No popularity contests, no worried eye on how many more the synagogue could pull in than he could. He dismissed the crowd, Mark says. Dismissed it in the literal sense of telling it goodbye, and dismissed it in the sense of refusing to make it a measure of success. Of course, no one was paying him to be a success, and no one kept an attendance book. So perhaps it was easier for him, but I do think he understood the danger. If drawing a crowd is the first motive of a teacher, any teacher, she may, unless she is one in a million, start pandering to popular sentiment, cutting back on expectations, cultivating an easy tolerance for apathy and ignorance, and then word gets around, the crowds show up. But like other great teachers, Jesus seemed as happy with two or three as he did with 5,000. He did not see a crowd as proof of success, and there is clear evidence that he actually tried to discourage them. He refused to say the things they wanted to hear, and in the setting for a brief little parable this morning, he throws ice water over their momentary heat. Here is how Luke tells it. Once when great crowds were accompanying him, he turned to them and said, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, even his own life, he cannot be a disciple of mine." Now, whatever those amazing words may mean, and we will try to make sense of them later, one thing is obvious. He is telling this crowd that unless they really mean business, they would do better to go back home. That's hardly the language of the organized church, with its debts to pay and its hunger for names on the membership roll. There may be ghosts in the church directory, whose bodies have not materialized in a pew for years. But we are reluctant to drop them because they keep up the count. And the count is the measure of success. Jesus was not so impressed by numbers. He taught a handful as if he thought they could change the world. If a huge crowd did show up, he didn't seem to feel that was necessarily a compliment. He knew that many of them were only curious and had come out to gape as they might at a chariot wreck or a fight between two camels. He knew that others were trying to figure out how to use him to advance their own interests. Merchants looking for profitable contacts. Super patriots hoping they could persuade him to lead a revolt. Priests wondering how to keep him from threatening their prestige and power. So he looked at the sea of faces, almost none of them with any notion of what he was trying to do. And he said something deliberately meant to alienate most of them. Instead of the hallowed invitation, "Come unto me, all ye that labor," he blew a chilling breath of realism over their excitement. All of a sudden, the familiar, sentimental image has vanished. The good physician, the shepherd of souls, the man who is all sweetness and light. In its place, a blunt warning. The price of discipleship is high. Either you put this challenge above everything else you hold dear, or go back to something not so costly. Because lives that can make a difference in the world have to have one transcendent loyalty. You try to make that loyalty serve your husband or wife, your child, your father or mother, but you do not turn away from it, even if, God forbid, you forfeit affection. Not only is this uncompromising language, it's also extremely dangerous. In the wrong mouth, for the wrong reason, it becomes the language of Jonestown and the mass suicide. But he said it. And if sitting in this room means that we take him seriously, then we have to figure out what he meant by such a hard saying. Because this is not quite the Christ figure most of us prefer to think about. Living as we do in the midst of power struggles, doing battle with our competitors, exhausted by our own special treadmills, we prefer to think of Christianity as a kind of fantasy island to which we can escape when we need an hour of gentle patience or a bath of warm forgiveness. Not often enough to be a bother, an hour a week, or perhaps not every week. And for conscience sake, almost always on the special days, when everybody else comes and we can be exhilarated by the crowd, Christmas and Easter especially, even if one goes at no other time because they both feature landscapes flooded with light and joy, and no harsh, painful words like the ones Jesus spoke to this crowd. He knew, of course, that people would be shocked, probably offended, But he hoped it might cause them to enter more deeply into the mystery of his unique approach to life, and to discover what it was he was asking them to do. But it must have been hard for them to understand his lack of interest in numbers, his sad knowledge that crowd enthusiasm has very little staying power. If he were involved in modern church life, he would be in trouble for noticing how many of us are on a kind of double track. On Sundays, when we visit church, surprised by some sudden flash of truth, genuinely pleased by the music or the quiet beauty of the place, but able to forget what it means the moment we return to the workaday world on Monday, as if a switch has been flipped. Looking at people around us as associates or competitors, but not as neighbors in whom Christ is present. Driving towards success with never a thought of whether the God we worship on Sunday could put his blessing on what we do on Wednesday. The prophet from the little hill town of Nazareth knew these things. So he looked at the faces in the crowd and saw that beneath a surface excitement, a momentary passion, they were too divided and too aimless to find real peace of mind in what he offered. That they wanted a little commitment to the holiness and beauty they saw in his life, but not too much. A decision he knew would only make them worse off than if they had never met him at all. He understood that there can be a certain kind of happiness in the purely secular life with no religious distractions to trouble contentment. And he understood that single-minded devotion to the way of life he proposed could bring the deepest joy we ever have a chance to know. But he also knew that we are only scattered and unfocused and even miserable when we try to live with one foot in each camp. So he looked at this crowd we've been talking about, running here today and sure to run somewhere else tomorrow. And he said, if you choose this way, then put it above everything else and reorder your whole life radically. Otherwise, you will only have been scratched slightly by this demanding dream, and the scratch will itch and sting you when otherwise you could have dropped back into whatever comfort life held for you before we met each other. Better to go back where you were than to get into this thing halfway. When our English translation speaks of hating those who are nearest and closest to us, it helps to remember that the word Jesus used was from an Aramaic root that means to love less. But we mustn't take the sting out of it, because Christ meant something very serious, intending to jolt the people who heard it. So he used a paradox to wake up sleepy minds, a truth standing on its head to attract attention. He knew that anyone really listening would get the point, would know better than to cancel out all the things they saw in his life every day, a man telling them literally to hate their parents who had taught them to love even their enemies, a man counseling disregard for children who took children into his arms over the protests of his own disciples in order to bless them. No, the paradox would have shocked them at first, which is what he wanted. And then the point would have come as clearly as one of the other Gospels trying to soften it a little bit, put it, the person who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of the way of life to which I call you. So, in practical terms, how does it work? This loving your own child, say, less than the ideals Christ stands for. Well, suppose that in what you consider your love for your child, you provide everything. Work yourself to death to buy clothes, cars, college. But all the time, there is in you no commitment to anything higher than such things. No notion of a kingdom of mind and spirit where we live above all those things while we use them. In that case, he would say you have cheated your child of the best thing you could have given. And this can be tested. When a child grows up, which is the highest compliment she can pay? This one, my folks gave me everything I wanted. Or this one, my parents showed me how to live with integrity, love, and compassion. We know the answer. But it does cost something to provide that kind of example, and it takes some staying power. So Jesus told a story so brief that it takes only three sentences. Would any of you think of building a tower without first sitting down and calculating the cost? Otherwise, all the onlookers will laugh. There is the person, they will say, who started to build and could not finish. This is the kind of uncompromising talk we expect from Lee Iacocca, trying to make Chrysler profitable, or from a research scientist to the lab team, or from some revolutionary trying to overthrow a corrupt government, but hardly the sort of appeal designed to lure half-hearted people into the Christian church. But above all else, Christ was realistic and truthful. It has always been the mark of a great leader to tell people openly what it will cost to follow. King Arthur, in Tennyson's great vision of an ideal kingdom upon the earth, bound his knights by such difficult vows that when they stood up, they were dazed and pale. I heard Winston Churchill say in the awful days of the Blitz over London that people would have to give blood, sweat, toil, and tears. Not much comfort for anyone hoping for quick and easy answers. And no one was more determined than Christ to let people know what they were getting into if they really meant business. So he put it squarely on the line, over and over in sentences like these: can you live by a higher law than the law of retaliation? Or will you be screaming for blood the moment someone wrongs you like all the rest of the world? What if those who love you most decide you're a fool for going against the main current of the times? Can you take that, hoping you may finally win them by a life of strength and beauty? There is, on the way to Dallas, a huge unfinished mansion just off the highway. Started years ago and never finished because the will faded, or the cash flow stopped, or the love that started it turned into something else. I think that for someone like Christ, it would have been even more tragic to see a landscape littered with the unfinished dreams of people who never really meant business. So, in the stern love that is the final test of integrity, he forces us to ask ourselves a question: how much do we really care?